Welcome to Local Voices on 94.7 KPIP LP Fayette. Brought to you by the Boonslick Historical Society and its president, respected Fayette community member, Jim Steele, journalist, graphic designer, and historian. This edition of Local Voices airs every Monday from noon to 4 p.m. and focuses on a glance back at the music and history of World War II as it affected Fayette, America, and the world. Thank you again for tuning in to this special edition, A Glance Back, here on Local Voices on 94.7 KPIP. Hundreds of thousands are protesting in Myanmar. A woman has been arrested near the White House with a loaded gun and a letter for President Biden. Colombia extends overnight warming centers through Thursday, and the Kansas City Corps of Engineers gives updates on Missouri River structure repairs. These are your headlines. I'm Rachel Steele, KPIP News. In international news, protests continue in Myanmar for the second week in a row after the country's military seized power in a coup and placed pro-democracy leader Suu Kyi under house arrest. The protests are the largest in more than a decade. According to Reuters, hundreds of thousands of people turned out on Sunday despite the risk of a police crackdown on protesters. Protesters are demanding Kyi's release and a return to democracy, but Myanmar's new military government has shown no willingness to grant either request despite 9 days of mass demonstrations. Myanmar's new military government has responded to the protests by trampling citizens' rights. Social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and WhatsApp have all been blocked in the country. Arrest orders have been issued for prominent activists, and security forces have deployed water cannons, rubber and live bullets, and more against peaceful protesters. The crackdown is a grim throwback to an earlier era in Myanmar's history. The country, which is also known as Burma, has been under military rule for much of its existence since winning independence from Britain in 1948. Since the coup, Myanmar's military government has been widely condemned by the international community, including the U.S., the United Nations, and international organizations like Human Rights Watch. President Joe Biden announced Wednesday that the U.S. will impose new sanctions on military leaders responsible for the coup and freeze about $1 billion in funds currently being held in the U.S. In national news, a woman was arrested near the White House after reportedly telling cops she had a special delivery for President Biden. The unidentified 66-year-old was stopped at a checkpoint in downtown D.C. close to the White House Saturday evening. Cops say she told them she was there to meet President Biden and to give him a handwritten letter. That prompted a search of the vehicle, where D.C. Metro said they discovered a loaded handgun. The woman was booked for possession of an unregistered firearm, and the case has since been referred to the Secret Service. This situation is eerily familiar, though. There was another arrest like this back in January, when a Virginia man also drove up to a checkpoint with allegedly fake inauguration credentials, a loaded firearm, and plenty of ammo. Just a day later, a woman was arrested under similar circumstances, coming up to a checkpoint and trying to pass herself off as a member of Biden's cabinet. In regional news, the city of Columbia has extended the operation of temporary overnight warming centers at places like the Wabash bus station. They've extended it through Thursday, February the 18th. The Wabash bus station is open from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. every night and is meant to be a resource for individuals unable to access local emergency shelter services. The city has also provided a list of other warming centers, which can be found online at como.gov. And in local news, the Kansas City District U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has released a report on the actions they have taken to repair and mitigate damage done to the river's structures on the Missouri River from high water over the last several years, including the major flooding in 2019. Crews have been repairing damaged structures all winter. However, work directly on the river has slowed recently due to dangerous floating ice. Even though river repairs have slowed, teams across the Kansas City District continue planning, engineering, and engaging in diagnostic work, readying themselves for the major repair work that will start this spring. Unfortunately, survey crews are currently on standby due to weather conditions. To date, survey crews have performed more than 185 riverbed studies and shared those with industry partners. A team from Ellis Construction remains on call in Glasgow so that when conditions allow, they can continue work on structures between river miles 240 and 260. This news is brought to you in part by the Glasgow Missourian and by listeners like you. These are your headlines. I'm Rachel Steele, KPIP News. Time for your KPIP weather forecast. I'm Rachel Steele, KPIP Weather, brought to you by the Petrichor Store on the Courthouse Square in Fayette. Today, the high is only 2 degrees, with negative 6 overnight and a 58% chance of snow showers. Tuesday, warming up to 13 degrees for your high, the low 5 degrees, with mostly cloudy skies. Snow for your Wednesday, the high 21, the low 9, and a 20% chance of some sprinkles or showers of snow on Thursday with a high of 21 and a low of negative 1. That's your forecast. I'm Rachel Steele, KPIP Weather. Back to World War II with Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP.
Thank you.
taking a glance back at history with Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP.
There is a land, a western land, mighty wonderful to see. It is the land I understand, and it's there I long to be.
The stars at night are big and bright, deep in the heart of Texas. The prairie sky is wide and high, deep in the heart of Texas. The sage in bloom is like perfume, deep in the heart of Texas. Reminds me of the one I love, deep in the heart of Texas. The coyotes wail along the trail, deep in the heart of Texas. The rabbits rush around the brush, deep in the heart of Texas. The cowboys cry, ki-yip-pi-yi, deep in the heart of Texas. The dokies bawl and bawl and bawl, deep in the heart of Texas.
Ole, ole.
Oh, the coyotes wail along the trail,
deep in the heart of Texas.
Ole, ole.
And the rabbits rush around the brush,
deep in the heart of Texas.
The sage in bloom is like perfume,
deep in the heart of Texas.
Big and bright, deep in the heart of Texas. The prairie sky is wide and high, deep in the heart of Texas. The cowboys cry, ki-yi-yi-yi-yi-yi, yippee-yi-yi, yippee-yi-yi-yi.
The dogies bawl and bawl and bawl, deep in the heart of dear old Texas, deep in the heart.
Tropical climes, there are certain times of day when all the citizens retire to take their clothes off and perspire. It's one of those rules the greatest fools obey, because the sun is far too sultry and one must avoid its ultraviolet ray. The natives grieve when the white men leave their huts, because they're obviously, definitely nuts. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The Japanese don't care to, the Chinese wouldn't dare to. Hindus and Argentines sleep firmly from 12 to 1. But Englishmen detest our siesta. In the Philippines they have lovely screens to protect you from the glare. In the Malay states there are hats like plates which the Britishers won't wear. At 12 noon the natives swoon and no further work is done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. Such a surprise for the eastern eyes to see that though the English are effete, they're quite impervious to heat. When the white man rides, every native hides in glee, because the simple creatures hope he will impale his soul a topi on a tree. It seems such a shame when the English claim the earth that they give rise to such hilarity and mirth. Mad dogs and English. Englishman go out in the midday sun. The toughest Burmese bandit can never understand it. In Rangoon, the heat of noon is just what the natives shun. They put the Scotch or rye down and lie down. In a jungle town where the sun beats down to the rage of man and beast, the English garb of the English Saab merely gets a bit more creased. In Bangkok, at 12 o'clock, they foam at the mouth and run. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The smallest Malay rabbit deplores its foolish habit. In Hong Kong, they strike a gong and fire off a noonday gun to reprimand each inmate who's in late. In the mangrove swamps where the python romps, there is peace from 12 to 2. Even caribous lie around and snooze, for there's nothing else to do. In Bengal, to move at all is seldom, if ever, done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday, 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 out in the midday sun.
You are listening to Local Voices on 94.7 KPIP. Now, our local historian, Jim Steele, will take us back to the age of World War II.
Today on KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back, we continue with the fourth and last historical account of how rural residents in this area eventually found the light as RAA electric lines ultimately covered the entirety of Howard County. Now, as we noted last week, by March of 1938, the first line virtually was complete, with 124 miles constructed, 152 meters set into the homes, and 210 paid members. Trunk lines were energized on May the 18th, 1938, and immediately crews began fusing the transformers. That was the last operation standing between farmers and their dream of having electricity for the first time. Power came into rural homes 2 days later, on May the 20th, 1938. But keep in mind that this 1938 milestone included only a relatively small part of the county, those homes located near the original main line. Other sections got wired in, as it was possible to do so, but in some cases this was not until the late 1940s or even as late as 1950. Nonetheless, between May 1938 and 1945, our county's RAA membership grew from 161 to 403 members. So today, as we continue this narrative, we'll endeavor to tell the rest of the story of how rural Howard County residents ultimately became fully electrified. This in spite of the Depression, World War II, and political maneuvering. For example, board members of Howard Electric forged ahead in the wake of efforts by RAA officials in Washington who pushed for consolidation of projects in three counties, Boone, Callaway, and Howard. Ultimately, all three counties rejected the proposal, so Howard Electric had met its first test and had survived. Now, the late Louise Couts noted in a 2002 news account by this writer that the first appliances purchased by most farm wives after the power was turned on were, well, you can guess it, a washing machine, refrigerator, and an electric iron. Howard Electric soon established a permanent organization, this under the direction of a board of directors, with a staff of clerical and maintenance workers supervised by a manager. His name was Thomas Biswald. Now, he'd been elected on a temporary basis in 1937, ultimately became the permanent manager until returning to full-time farming in 1944. Biswell was succeeded by J.C. Omer of New London, Missouri. For the first 10 years of Howard Electric's operation, many of the farm homes were wired by a Fayette electrician. Jordan Cooper was his name. Original Howard County offices were located, as we told you earlier, in the courthouse, followed later by a move to larger quarters on the second floor of the Commercial Trust Company building. In 1956, the co-op would occupy its own building. It was a former poultry processing facility at the southeast corner of Elm and Church in Fayette, and this is still remembered by many older residents of this area. Now, as we noted last week, wartime priorities following the attack on Pearl Harbor caused installation of wiring on the farm homes to come to halt almost immediately. This particularly was due to copper shortages. Any project 40% complete as of December 5th, 1941, could be completed. But by 3 months later, all RAA line work had been halted, regardless of status. Co-op employees during the war years were only four in number, two linemen, an office girl, and the manager. Because of the need to ration tires and gasoline, Howard Electric in 1942 initiated the practice of having members mail in their meter readings. Now, in the earlier days, co-op personnel had read the meters themselves. Now, two significant developments came at war's end in 1945. The co-op secured its first line truck. Before that, employees used their own trucks and got mileage reimbursed. And also, it gets approval, the co-op gets approval, for a $265,000 REA loan. In those early post-war years, Howard Electric and other co-ops often faced resistance from private utilities, which had refused to serve local residents or rural residents in the first place. Now, these were known as spite lines, and they were built by private or municipal power companies. It was a practice called cherry-picking in order to serve more profitable, densely populated areas or areas with larger loads. As you might expect, this hurt the co-op's sustainability and their efforts to expand with new customers after the war. Our highly regarded manager, J.C. Omer, would serve from 1944 to 1958, a 14-year streak, which would be the longest in Howard Electric's history until Richard Fowler passed this mark in the year 2005, and who continues to serve today. Now, Mr. Omer became a noted leader in the statewide group, now known as the Association of Missouri Electric Cooperatives. He had led efforts in 1948 to establish a safety and job training program for the association, and in that year it was reported that Missouri farms, 1948 now, were now 50% electrified. By the time of Howard County's annual meeting in 1950, it was reported here that our cooperative had achieved complete area coverage with 1,564 members. By 1954, this had grown to 1,700 members and 600 miles of line around the county. Average household energy use increased fivefold between 1938 and 1954 as the load on rural lines grew with the use of electricity by members. Now, of course, this increased from simple electric lights to ranges, water heaters, farm equipment, and other modern appliances. Sometimes in those growing years, a small number of farms would have to be cut off for an hour or so due to overloads. As we reported earlier, in Fayette's municipal power plant had furnished power for 11 years, beginning in 1938. But by 1949, Howard Electric joined with four other mid-Missouri co-ops to form the Jefferson City-based Central Electric Cooperative. Later, three more systems joined, and it became Mid-State 8 Electric Co-ops. But nonetheless, there were still some problems coming from private power companies, with newspaper ads claiming that co-ops building their own power plants were virtually, in their words, undermining the American way of life. Private companies brought lawsuits in the courts, and it wasn't until 1955 that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that electric co-ops had the right to borrow money from the government to build generators and transmission facilities. On August 15, 1954, the Central Electric Cooperative dedicated a new power generating plant at Chamois, this following a running battle with private power companies which sought to block construction. It was a new day in rural electrification, as Howard County now would be in control of its own destiny, this after overcoming a number of roadblocks. Now, once the plant came online, the co-op would take its power from Chamois instead of the Fayette Municipal Plant. A substation was added in Yates, that's in the northern part of Howard County. This improved reliability. By 1959, our cooperative had 528 miles of line serving 1,678 customers, and after more than 20 years in business, had never increased rates, absorbing rising costs year after year. The 1960s were good years, with the Kennedy administration providing a more comfortable climate for co-ops than had the Eisenhower administration. Also, many new electrical appliances and devices had come into widespread use, mercury vapor lamps, for example, in addition to electrical farming equipment, such as heat lamps for farrow pigs, grain dryers, and so forth. As power needs increased, electricity for the various regional transmission groups ultimately became supplied by a new concept, the Associated Electric Cooperative, which would build coal-fired plants at Thomas Hill and New Madrid. But with cheap rates in the 1960s, rural residents continued to jump on the bandwagon by using electricity in multiple ways, including electric heat. However, the era of cheap rates was about to end. Expenses associated with adding new generating equipment and other factors such as pollution control caused the rates to soar. In 1975, the RAA Howard Electric Co-op vacated its Church Street location for a new site north of Fayette on Highway 5240, using land that had been purchased back in 1961. This original 1975 building has had, as you probably know, several expansions and upgrades over the years. Our local co-op managed to weather the farm crisis of the 1980s, which saw many farm foreclosures in Howard County and elsewhere. The existence of Howard County as a strictly local entity was again threatened. In 1981, a proposal to merge operations with Moon Electric is proposed. However, ultimately, our co-op members voted down the merger. The early and mid-1980s were rough years for the co-op because of rate increases and the need to deal with storms and bad weather, including the worst ice storm in the organization's history. That was in 1985. Nonetheless, Howard Electric saw it through. By 1986, the co-op had enough income to exceed expenses, and a peak alert program was established. In the late 1980s, Howard Electric again fought off a territory grab in Randolph County, this by Union Electric. By 1988, members could subscribe to rural television programming, with 35 channels available, and 2 years later, a branch office in Moberly was opened to serve members of Howard, Boone, and Macon Electric Cooperatives. Finally, in 1990, Richard Fowler becomes the 11th manager of the Howard Electric Cooperative and continues in that role today, the longest tenure in the co-op's history. Now, as a final side note, today is President's Day. So, as we conclude our look back at the history of rural electricity in Howard County, it's entirely appropriate to salute the presidential hero who spearheaded the nationwide effort to bring the light to those living in rural areas. Now, as late as the mid-1930s, 9 out of 10 rural homes were without electric service. The farmer milked his cows by hand in the dim light of a kerosene lantern. His wife was a slave to the woods range and the washboard. The unavailability of electricity in rural areas kept their economics entirely and exclusively dependent on agriculture. Factories and businesses, of course, preferred to locate in cities where electric power was easily acquired. For many years, power companies ignored the rural areas of the nation. The first official action of the federal government, pointing the way to the present rural electrification program, came with FDR's advocacy of the Tennessee Valley Authority, better known as the TVA. That act was passed in May of 1933. The idea of providing federal assistance to accomplish rural electrification had gained ground rapidly when President Roosevelt took office in 1933. On May the 11th, 1935, FDR signed Executive Order Number 7037, establishing the Rural Electrification Administration, better known as RAA. But it was not until a year later that the Rural Electrification Act was passed by Congress, and this led the program that the RAA and got underway. Now, within months, it was evident that two RAA officials that established investor-owned utilities were not interested in using federal loan funds to serve sparsely populated rural areas. But loan applications from farmer-based cooperatives, such as here in Howard County, poured in. And the RAA soon realized electric cooperatives would be the entities to make rural electrification a reality. In 1937, the RAA drafted the Electric Cooperative Cooperation Act as a model law that states could adopt to enable the formation and operation of not-for-profit consumer-owned electric cooperatives. Within 4 years following the close of World War II, the number of rural electric systems in operation doubled. The number of consumers connected more than tripled, and the miles of energized line grew more than fivefold. By 1953, more than 90% of U.S. farms had electricity. Today, about 99% of the nation's farms have electric service. Most rural electrification is the product of locally owned rural electric cooperatives, such as ours, that got their start by borrowing funds from RAA to build lines and provide service on a not-for-profit basis. RAA now is called the Rural Utility Service, and it's part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. False claims that electric cooperatives were hoarding copper wire during World War II brought co-op leaders from different states together in that year to defend themselves. As a result, in 1942, America's electric cooperatives formed the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, this to provide a unified voice for co-ops and to represent their interest in Washington, D.C. Today, it represents more than 900 consumer-owned, not-for-profit electric co-ops, plus public power districts and public utility districts in the United States. The Arlington, Virginia-based National Service Organization oversees co-op employee benefit plans, carries out federal government relations, such as lobbying, conducts management and director training, and spearheads communication advocacy and public relations initiatives. In addition, it coordinates national and regional conferences and seminars, offering member cooperatives advice on tax, legal, environmental, and engineering matters. And it performs economic and technical research as well. And so on this President's Day, we remember that it all began with the progressive thinking of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. For KPIP Local Voices, to Glance Back, this is Jim Steele reporting.
That was our glance back in time with Jim Steele, president of the Boonslick Historical Society. This series with Jim Steele will continue every Monday from noon to 4 p.m. during Local Voices, only on 94.7 KPIP.
On, I had a lot of care. I had a lot of worry and troubles everywhere, but now I've got no worry and troubles thrown away. I'm living like a millionaire and not a cent to pay. I've got sixpence, jolly, jolly sixpence. I've got sixpence to last me all my life. I've got tuppence to spend and tuppence to lend and tuppence to send unto my wife. No cares have I to grieve me, no pretty little girl to deceive me. I'm as happy as a king, believe me, as I go rolling home, rolling home, rolling home. As I go rolling home, I'm as happy as a king, believe me, as I go rolling home.
President's Day from 94.7 KPIP. I'm Rachel Steele, and today, in honor of the holiday, we'll take a look back at the life of Missouri's native son, President Harry S. Truman. Harry S. Truman was born in Lamar, Missouri on May 8, 1884, and grew up in Independence, Missouri. He was the oldest child of John Anderson Truman and Martha Ellen Young Truman. Truman began a long career of service to our country during World War I, where he was stationed in France as a captain in the field artillery. After returning home, he opened a haberdashery, or hat shop, in Kansas City, Missouri, and was later elected as a Jackson County official in 1922. In 1934, Truman entered politics on a national level by being elected to the United States Senate from Missouri and gained national prominence as the chairman of the Truman Committee aimed at reducing waste and inefficiency in wartime contracts. Truman was sworn in as the 33rd President of the United States upon the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1945. He served as our president from 1945 to 1953, a period of time in which he implemented the Marshall Plan to rebuild the economy of Western Europe and establish the Truman Doctrine and NATO. Soon after succeeding to the presidency, he authorized the first and only use of nuclear weapons in war, ordering the bombing of the Japanese cities Nagasaki and Hiroshima, bringing an end to the war in the Pacific.
Received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government in reply to the message forwarded to that government by the Secretary of State on August 11th. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. In the reply, there is no qualification. Arrangements are now being made for the formal signing of the surrender terms at the earliest possible moment. General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the Japanese surrender. Great Britain, Russia, and China will be represented by high-ranking officers. Meantime, the Allied armed forces have been ordered to suspend offensive action. The proclamation of VJ Day must await upon the formal signing of the surrender terms by Japan.
Truman's administration engaged in an internationalist foreign policy and renounced isolationism, running on the ideals of the New Deal coalition during the 1948 presidential election, where Truman won a surprise victory that secured his own presidential term. After the onset of the Cold War, Truman oversaw the Berlin Airlift and Marshall Plan in 1948. when North Korea invaded South Korea in 1950, he gained United Nations approval to intervene in what became known as the Korean War. On domestic issues, bills endorsed by Truman faced opposition from a conservative Congress, but his administration successfully guided the U.S. economy through the post-war economic challenges. In 1948, he submitted the first comprehensive civil rights legislation and issued Executive Order 9981 to start racial integration in the military and federal agencies. After handing the White House over to Republican Dwight D. Eisenhower, Truman went into a financially difficult retirement, marked by the founding of his presidential library and the publication of his memoirs. When he left office, Truman's presidency was criticized, though critical reassessment of his tenure has been favorable. On December 5, 1972, Truman was admitted to Kansas City's Research Hospital and Medical Center with pneumonia. He developed multiple organ failure, fell into a coma, and died at 7:50 a.m. on December 26, 1972. He was 88 years old. For more information on Missouri's favorite son, visit the Howard County Public Library and ask one of the volunteers to help you find out more about President Harry S. Truman. Celebrating President's Day, I'm Rachel Steele on 94.7 KPIP.
Moonlight becomes you. It goes with your hair. You certainly know the right thing to wear. Moonlight becomes you. I'm thrilled at the sight. And I could get so romantic tonight. You're all dressed up to go dreaming. Now don't tell me I'm wrong. What a night to go dreaming. Mind if I tag along? If I say I love you, I want you to know. It's not just because there's moonlight, although moonlight becomes you so. To go dreaming. Now don't tell me I'm wrong. What a night to go dreaming. Mind if I tag along? If I say I love you, I want you to know. It's not just because there's moonlight, although moonlight becomes you so.
roaming in the park at night. All the darkness is a boo.
Who cares if we're without a light? They can't black out the moon.
I see you smiling in the cigarette glow, though the picture fades too soon.
But I see all I want to know. They can't black out the moon. We don't grumble. We don't worry about alarm.
Oh, when you stumble, you stumble right into my arms.
And when you kiss me, don't you realize that my heart's like a big balloon?
And like the love light in your eyes,
they can't black out the moon.
You gotta have crackle or spark, not brown.
Snap, crackle, Rice Krispies.
I insist that pop the sound. The best was missed unless pops around. You can't stop hopping and the cereal's popping.
Snap, crackle, Rice Krispies.
Billy Brown, the smoothest, coolest guy in town. The chicks all seem to dig his jive.
Hey, tell us, Bill, how can we arrive?
It's easy, Jack. Any gal gets sent when you flash a smile by Pepsodent.
You'll wonder where the yellow went when you brush your teeth with Pepsodent.
Pepsodent's new improved formula cleans teeth whiter than ever. Tastes brighter, too. New formula Pepsodent contains IMP. There's nothing else as good at getting teeth white.
You'll wonder where the yellow went when you brush your teeth with Pepsodent.
Perhaps you're lucky enough to have one in the service home on leave. And you wouldn't be human if you didn't want to know about everything he's doing. Nor would it be unnatural for him to want to tell you. And yet that very enthusiasm, that desire to confide, can bring tragedy. Even when you're with family or friends and are sure no enemy agent can hear, it isn't safe to mention items of war information. Remember, things which don't seem important to you may be of vital importance in a link of information. So don't ask and don't tell where our soldiers are, how many there are, how they are being transported, when they're going, or what kind of duty they're going on. If you do hear it from someone, don't repeat it. If you see it yourself, don't repeat it. But if you read it in the newspapers or hear it on the radio, you can talk all you like. Otherwise, mum's the word.
The greatest generation lives here on 94.7 KPIP.
You're driving me crazy. What did I do? Oh, do. Baby, my tears make everything hazy. cloud in the sky, mountain blue. Oh, baby, when you do the dumb, when it at the low. When it happy, don't bite it, it's bite it, oh, low. But, baby, you're driving me crazy. What did I do, baby? What did you do?
Swing. Swing it, you dog.
Kids eat Armor hot dogs.
Fat kids.
Kid.
Even kids with chicken pox love hot
dogs. I'm a hot dog.
The dog kids love to bite.
Picking it up on the old banjo, put on the mustard and away we go.
When kids fight dogs, they yell,
hooray for hot dogs!
Armor hot dogs!
The dog kids love to
fight! Friends, it's so foolish to suffer with an ordinary headache when Bromo Seltzer gives you such fast, pleasant, three-way relief.
It's true, Mr. Wheat. Bromo Seltzer is so pleasant to take, and it works so fast to help your headache all three ways.
Yes, Bromo Seltzer speedily fights the headache pain itself. Then it goes right to work to soothe the upset stomach and jangled nerves that often may team up with a headache. Try it next time you get a headache. Prove to yourself just how fast it works to help your headache all three ways.
We've tried a lot of headache products. But it's Bromo Seltzer from now on for our family.
You'll say the same thing, too, once you've discovered Bromo Seltzer. So get a bottle today and be prepared at all times to fight a headache fast all three ways.
It's smart to keep Bromo Seltzer both at home and at your place of business.
That's right, folks. Remember, Bromo Seltzer gives you fast three-way help for a headache. It's on sale at all drugstores. Caution, use only as directed. If headaches recur or persist, see your doctor. Get Bromo Seltzer today and...
I get it three ways. Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer.
Thank you for tuning in to Local Voices this Monday on 94.7 KPIP. Brought to you by the Boonslick Historical Society and its president, respected Fayette community member Jim Steele, journalist, graphic designer, and historian. This Glance Back at History edition of the Local Voices program airs every Monday from noon to 4 p.m. and focuses on the music and history of World War II as it affected Fayette, America, and the world. We'll see you next Monday, only on 94.7 KPIP.